Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we are live from 2 to 3 in the afternoon Pacific Daylight Time. I think only one more week before it'll be Pacific Standard Time. I am in Toronto, so I'm not in the Pacific Daylight Time Zone. I'm teaching for Youth with a Mission here for the first part of this week, until Thursday anyway, and then I expect to be home to do the show from there on Friday. And I should mention that on Thursday, because I will be traveling home, I will not be able to do the show. So I'm going to have our producer play the second part. I think it was the second part that we need to hear yet, of the debate I had with Matt Slick. I understand part of that was, the first part was played while I was away in Sweden. And we didn't get the second part played. So if I'm not incorrect about that, we will make up that deficiency on Thursday. You know, I almost wasn't able to do the show today. I brought all my equipment with me, I thought, because I can travel and bring this portable broadcasting equipment with me. But when I got unpacked and was about ready to do the show today, I noticed that I was lacking an adapter that I need to plug my headphones into the broadcasting equipment. And without that, I can't hear anything, so I would not be able to do the show. So about a half hour ago, when I was looking at all this, I thought, I'm not going to be able to do the show this week at all while I'm here in Toronto because I didn't bring this adapter. But then I remembered that on the flight here, they had, for $1, I was able to purchase a headset on the airplane, which is, I didn't actually use it on the airplane, but I thought, well, for a dollar, it wouldn't hurt to have a little headset. And it happens to have the right size plug, so I'm wearing that cheap $1 headphones and doing the program otherwise normally. If you'd like to be on the program, I don't think I've given the number out yet, though there's some calls waiting. We have one line open, and that number is 1-800-438-5090. I need to say that my voice sounds strange in my headphones, but then I'm using these cheap $1 headphones, so that might be it. If my voice is not coming across well over the air, that is, if we have a bad connection for any reason, I'd like my producer to maybe text me that and let me know if I sound normal or not. We're going to go to the phones. Like I say, we have one line open at 1-800-438-5090. And our first caller today is William, calling from Marina, California. Hi, William. Welcome to the Narrow Path.
Hi. How are you today?
I'm fine, thanks.
Yeah, my question today is, how come the Bible says that David was a man after God's own heart when he committed, you know, all these atrocities? I mean, from what I see, you know, he went and had another man's woman, and he had this man killed in the army. You know, how does that work? I have a two-part question. And the second part is, I'd like to know, and David's lineage, his son, Solomon's son, went away from, you know, the things of God. And when they do the Ashburn poles and stuff, what does that mean? Are they sacrificing human babies? Why is God so angry? Well, you know, they mention these, I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right, the Ashburn poles and these other gods and all this stuff they do.
Well, the Asherah poles were monuments to the goddess Asherah, or Astarte, who was believed to be Baal's wife in the Canaanite paganism. And most of those Canaanite religions were very, very debauched and very corrupt. They weren't religions like we think of them today. We usually think of a religious person as someone who's maybe adopted some kind of a special morality in order to please God. The pagan religions of Canaan were just the opposite. They were just orgies, really. And sometimes they did sacrifice babies. I think most of the infant sacrifices were in connection with the worship of Moloch, another of the Canaanite deities. But the Hebrew people many times worshipped both. I mean, they would worship Asherah, they'd worship Baal, they'd worship Moloch, they'd worship Jehovah too at the same time. They were just really quite eclectic. But obviously, worshiping Jehovah was much more morally demanding upon them. They had to not do corrupt things if they were going to worship Jehovah, whereas they could indulge their lusts in following these Canaanite deities. And so I think that's why they were so often tempted back into these pagan religions, because those pagan religions were so gratifying to the baser lusts. And that's also why God was upset with them, not just because God has something against people having a good time, or that God is against sex or anything like that. The problem here is that Israel was God's covenant people, and that covenant was analogous to a marriage covenant. God was said to be Israel's husband, and Israel was God's wife, and the worship of Yahweh, the worship of God, was the only permitted worship for Israel because of that. And when they went off and worshipped other gods, God always viewed it as a man would look at it if his wife was sleeping with other men. Worshipping other gods was committing adultery for Israel, and that's what made God upset about it, just like most men would be angry if their wives were committing adultery. So that's that one. Now, as far as David being called a man after God's own heart, that was said of him very early in his life. Samuel told Saul that God had rejected Saul because of Saul's rejection of the word of the Lord, and that God had therefore sought for himself another, a man after his own heart, which turned out to be David. So David was a man after God's own heart, but in his older age, he had his problems. Well, I hope you're a man after God's own heart. I know I am, and yet I'm not perfect. You know, to say you're a man after God's heart doesn't mean that you never sin. And David was quite corruptible, just like everybody else. And when he became rich and powerful and pampered and, you know, had, you know, access to everything he could ever want, he tended to get a little soft in his spirituality, I think. And I think he became a little carnal. And in that reduced spiritual condition, I think he was more vulnerable than he would have been at an earlier time in his life to the kinds of temptations that we find him falling into.
Was it okay with God for David to have so many wives and concubines and all that?
Yeah, apparently. I mean, the Old Testament didn't forbid it. In fact, when David slept with Bathsheba, that's one of the things that God actually said through the prophet Nathan to David. He says, you know, I gave you all of Saul's kingdom and his wives and everything. He said, if that hadn't been enough, I would have given you more. But he said, why did you have to go after this other man's wife? In other words, David had succeeded the previous king after Saul's death and inherited the concubines of Saul as well as whatever David brought into the kingdom with him. But that was considered to be, I mean, in those days, I mean, not just in Israel, but in all lands, the man who became the successor to the previous king inherited all that king had had, including his slave girls, and David inherited those. But he was wrong to take Uriah's wife because that was, well, she was someone else's wife.
So did God prohibit polygamy?
What's that?
When did God prohibit polygamy? When did that come into?
Well, there's not an actual command in the scripture that prohibits polygamy, but the reason that polygamy has not been practiced historically by Christians is because the Bible teaches that marriage is supposed to be a picture of Christ and the church. And Christians have understood that there's only one bride of Christ, the true church, and therefore Christ is monogamous. Christ doesn't have multiple brides. And therefore, men who are Christian men are supposed to, as much as possible, have their married lives resemble the relationship of Christ and the church, so much so that the men are supposed to love their wives as Christ loves the church, which is exclusive. Christ loves the church in an exclusive way, and the church is supposed to love Christ in an exclusive way. And therefore, for a Christian man and a Christian woman to approximate that in their married life requires monogamy.
So you're saying that Christ instituted, it was okay in the Old Testament, but when Christ came, then it wasn't okay.
I'm saying that when Christ came, a greater revelation was given to man than had previously been given as to the mysterious symbolic meaning of marriage. In the Old Testament, marriage was largely seen just as a means of starting, of having a family and nothing else. And many men would find that they had married a woman who, for whatever reasons, could not give them a family. Maybe she was barren. And so they would take additional wives, hoping that one of their wives would be able to give them children and give them a family. That's, in the Old Testament, they knew nothing much about the meaning of marriage, other than it was the means for growing a family. And there are were situations in which, so that people might have families, men sometimes took additional women as wives. Now, also, in those days, it was not uncommon for men to be wiped out in great numbers in battles. There were a lot of wars going on, and the male population was often quite decimated, which would leave a lot of widows. And there wasn't really a social structure like we have. So there wasn't Social Security or welfare or whatever for the widows in those days that we have. And often the very best means of giving a widow security was for her to be married to a man, even if he already had another wife. So a man would sometimes have additional wives. It says in Isaiah chapter 4, it speaks of a time where the male population will be so wiped out in Israel through war that there'd be seven women for each man, and all seven women wanting to be married to one man. And that situation was probably rather extreme, where the ratio is 7-1, but it was not too unusual for the female population to greatly outnumber the male population because of war and such. And so, I mean, for various reasons, so that women could have a family even if their husband was dead, and even if there weren't enough men to go around, I think polygamy was permitted. Also because there were barren women, and a man who had a barren wife couldn't have children unless he took additional wife, or more, sometimes. Those were, I think, the reasons that polygamy was practiced, and that's just that no better reason for marriage was known in the Old Testament times, except for family creation. But in the New Testament, there's a higher purpose for marriage given as a picture of Christ in the church, and once that is understood, there's a greater duty of people to conform to a higher standard. And therefore, monogamy seems to be the only appropriate standard for Christians.
So sin is just a matter of not knowing, you know, if God came tomorrow and just said, you know, I got something new for you guys to do that may not be sin today, but tomorrow, if God said it's a sin, then it would be a sin tomorrow. I'm a little confused about that.
Well, I haven't said anything about sin. We weren't talking about sin.
Oh,
We're talking about whether God had forbidden polygamy or not. I said he didn't.
Okay.
In the Bible, he does not forbid polygamy. But to say something is sin, if we mean in the broadest sense sin, the broadest sense is sin is just missing the mark. It's imperfection. In that sense, I guess we are all sinning all the time. But the sense that God holds us responsible for sin is when we're violating his commands. And, for example, in the law of Moses, God made it illegal, or wrong, sinful, for a man to marry his own sister. But in the Old Testament, before Moses' time, people married their sisters not infrequently. In fact, Adam and Eve's children all had to marry brothers and sisters. And even 20 generations later, Abraham was still married to his half-sister. And that was not wrong, but it was later wrong. It would later have been wrong in the law of Moses. So it's not wrong to do something if God didn't forbid it. But when God forbade it, then it becomes wrong to do it. Yeah.
Okay.
Sin is transgression of the law.
I think I understand a little bit.
Okay, William. Well, I'm getting some feedback. I don't know if that's my equipment or if it's our connection. We'll see when I talk to the next caller if we still have the same problem.
Right.
But good talking to you.
Thank you.
Thanks for your call. Bye now. You're listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and you can call me if you'd like to if you have a question about the Bible or Christianity, or if you have a disagreement with something I've said on the air today or any other day, feel free to give me a call. The number is 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. Our next call is from Nathan, calling from Imperial, California. Hi, Nathan. Welcome to the Narrow Path.
Hi there, Steve. Hey, this wasn't why I called, but it's just triggered by the first caller. In talking about, he asked about whether it was acceptable for the kings to marry multiple wives. And I was just wondering, Moses, I think, in Deuteronomy 17:17, in speaking about the future kings of Israel, didn't he say that they were not to take
they were not to multiply
wives unto themselves?
Yeah.
Now I'm just wondering how that might bring up.
Well, I'm sure that see the same passage in Deuteronomy 17 said they should not multiply horses. So I guess the question is, what does it mean to multiply? If a man had 8 or 10 wives and 8 or 10 horses, he might say, "I'm not multiplying horses or wives. I'm just adding them." when you get to Solomon, he had 700 wives. I'd say that was multiplying. I don't know how you can add that many in a lifetime. You're gonna have to start doing some multiplication to get that many.
Yeah, that's a good point. Definition of multiplying, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, I'm being a little bit flipped there because I don't really know how many wives constitutes multiplying wives as far as Deuteronomy is concerned.
Sure.
Just as I don't know how many horses constitutes multiplying horses. But I'm sure that in saying that he shouldn't multiply horses, I don't think that's saying he only had to have one horse.
Yeah. I that's certainly true. I agree with that. Okay, interesting. The main reason why I called was wondering about the passage in Matthew 21, verses 18 to 22, which is the famous passage about Jesus going up to the fig tree, finding the fruit on it, and cursing it, and it dies. I've never taken it, before it's more than just sort of at face value. But as I was looking at it the other day, I suddenly realized, how many symbolic objects or whatever, common symbols appear in that small set of verses. And given the context, given the nearness of that passage to other, to the parables of the landowner and the parables of the wedding feast.
Yeah,
I'm wondering if we really should be taking this as more than just a simple statement about faith. Jesus talks, and they ask him how this is possible that he, could have cursed the fig tree and it died right there on the spot. He says, if you have faith and do not doubt, then you can say to this mountain, be cast into the sea, and it will be so. But in looking at the symbols, I mean, this fig tree, a commonly recognized symbol for Israel, Jesus finds no fruit on it and commands it to die, and they ask him about this, he says, if you have enough faith, you can talk faith to this mountain. Obviously Israel was Jerusalem in particular, where they were, was built
on Zion.
Zion. And it can be thrown into the sea. The sea, if I understand it right, is a common symbol for the Gentile nations.
That's right.
The symbolism seems to me to be, very, when I looked at it over the weekend, I suddenly saw this symbolism there. It seemed very clear, especially given the nearness of, of this passage to other passages which talk about the destruction, what I think talk about the destruction of Israel. I'm wondering if we should maybe be looking at this passage, taking it with more than just a simple statement about having faith. And if this is the case, then what it seems like a strange way in my mind to present the this idea that there was some judgment coming on Israel as some sort of a living parable almost. It seems like a strange wind, and why in the world does Jesus talk about it? If this was his purpose, to create this some sort of prophetic parable, why is he talking about faith in the middle of it? If you have the faith to do this, then you can say to the mountain, "Be cast into the sea, and it will be done, and it will happen."
Well, that's interesting that all those connections. I personally do believe that the fig tree represents Israel in that place, although, as you point out, it never says so.
Yeah.
The passage. And when Jesus is asked about it, the only thing he ever says, by way of explanation, is that, you know, well, if you have faith, you can do the same kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a lot of evidence there that it's a symbolic action representing the judgment that was coming on Israel. And perhaps his statement about their faith is suggesting that their faith and their prayers may be instrumental in bringing this judgment on Israel. Now, you know, say, well, that doesn't sound very loving, but actually, it's very agreeable with, you know, Luke chapter 18, where it says he spoke a parable to them that men ought always to pray and not lose hearts. He said, there was a certain city with a judge who did not fear God or regard man. Now, there was a widow in that city, and she came to him saying, get justice for me from my adversary. And he would not for a while, but afterward he said within himself, though I do not fear God or regard man, yet because this widow troubles me, I will avenge her, lest by her continual coming she weary me. Then the Lord said, hear what the unjust judge said, and shall not God avenge his own elect, who cry out day and night to him, though he bears long with them? I tell you that he will avenge them speedily. Nevertheless, when the Son of Man comes, will he really find the faith on the earth? Now, Jesus is telling a parable presumably about prayer,
mm-hmm.
and about how men ought always to pray and not lose heart. And yet he says, God will avenge his elect who cry out to him. He will avenge them speedily. They're crying out to him for that he would avenge them. And in the book of Revelation, and when the fifth seal is opened in chapter 6 of Revelation, it says John saw the souls of those who had been beheaded before the throne, and they were saying, how long, O Lord, before you avenge our blood on those who dwell on the land? And I believe, not all people see Revelation the way I do, of course, but I believe this is talking about the early Christian martyrs who were, as the book of Acts points out, killed largely by the hostility of the Sanhedrin and the Jewish religion that persecuted them. The Sanhedrin killed Jesus. The Sanhedrin stoned Stephen. They approved of they encouraged the killing of James by Herod and also the arrest of Peter. They also commissioned Saul, to go out and persecute Christians worldwide. And when he became a Christian, they sent people around to try to kill him. Jerusalem and its ruling body were the primary persecutors of the early Christians. The martyrs were the products of Jewish hostility, and Jesus even said that in Matthew 23. He said that Jerusalem, I will send you wise men and prophets and so forth, and you'll kill them, and you'll pursue them, and you'll persecute them. And he said that all the blood that was shed of all the martyrs from Abel to Zechariah will come on this generation. Now, Jesus is saying that Jerusalem is going to be judged as God's vengeance for the blood of the martyrs. In another place, Jesus had said to the Pharisees, he said, it cannot be that a prophet will perish outside Jerusalem, which was a sarcastic remark. It wasn't exactly meant to be taken literally, because some prophets do die outside Jerusalem. But he was saying, Jerusalem is so—it's so characteristic of Jerusalem to kill their prophets. One could not imagine a prophet dying anywhere else. So, in a sense, the vengeance for the blood of the martyrs, which the martyrs are crying out for in Revelation, is brought upon the city of Jerusalem. And Jesus, in that parable, that the widow's crying out to the judge for that he would avenge her. God says to his disciples, God will avenge his elect who cry out to him. So the praying with faith in this particular case is praying for God to avenge the blood of the martyrs and to bring an end to the persecution that was being spearheaded by Jerusalem and its Sanhedrin.
Mm-hmm.
And so in the cursing of the fig tree, I think, represents the judgment coming upon Jerusalem. And when Jesus said, if you have similar faith, you can say to this mountain, be uprooted and be cast in the sea, and it'll be done. I agree. I think this mountain, he was standing right at the foot of the Mount Zion, and that's where Jerusalem is. And he said, if you say to this mountain, be thrown into the sea, which, as you say, is a common figure of speech for the nations, of the Gentile nations, well, then he is actually making a statement that if you are praying and faithfully praying, you will be instrumental in God bringing vengeance upon those that are persecuting you. That's what I think is going on there. Now, there's so much else in the context to indicate that Jesus, in cursing the fig tree, is thereby giving an emblem of the judgment on Jerusalem. Because, as you say, he tells the parable of the vineyard. He tells the parable of the wedding feast in the same context. But more than that, he had earlier told a parable about a fig tree in Luke chapter 13. This is a relatively little-known parable. It doesn't get preached on very much. But in Luke chapter 13, verse 6, Jesus spoke this parable. A certain man had a fig tree planted in his vineyard, and he came seeking fruit on it and found none. Then he said to the keeper of his vineyard, "Look, for 3 years I've come seeking fruit on this fig tree and find none. Cut it down. Why does it burden the ground?" But he answered and said to him, "Sir, let it alone this year also until I dig around it and fertilize it. And if it bears fruit, well. If not, after that you can cut it down." Now that's the whole parable. There's no explanation given. But it's about a fig tree planted in a vineyard. Well, Israel was God's vineyard. The fig tree probably was Jerusalem in the midst of it. And he says the owner of the fig tree, which would be God, says to the caretaker, who is probably Jesus, "You know, let's cut this tree down. I'm looking for fruit, and there's no fruit on it." And the caretaker says, "Give it one more year." It's been 3 years, which is perhaps how long Jesus had been ministering. And, you know, we've given it 3 years, and it hasn't produced anything. Let's give it just this year also, and if it doesn't work out, we'll take it down. And it's possible that when Jesus cursed the fig tree then, as he was ascending to Jerusalem in his final week, he was saying, well, the tree didn't produce fruit. He even looked for fruit on it to make sure. And when there's no fruit on it, he cursed it, basically said it's getting torn down. And it actually withered up right on the spot to prove that he was not mistaken. But it was like an acted parable, I believe. And it was acting out, actually miraculously, something that Jesus was actually saying in parables and propositions and declarations in the remaining chapters before his death.
Okay, yeah, that makes some sense, you know, looking at it in light of those other passages. Because, yeah, the main thing, it seemed to me that the symbolism, you know, when I thought, looked at it over the weekend, was so clear to me in a progression of events, so that I just didn't know what to make of the statement about faith. So that,
many people have no idea how important the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70 was in mm-hmm. God's economy. And once you see it, you see that Jesus is talking about little else in the final week. You know, his parables are about that. His cursing the fig tree is about that. His denunciation of the scribes and Pharisees is about that. His declaration that all the blood of the martyrs is going to come on that generation is about that. And then when he walks out of the temple and he says not one stone is going to be left on another, that's about that.
Yeah.
And then he gives the Olivet Discourse, and that's about that. You know, it's like everything from chapter 21 through 24. Is pretty much different ways that Jesus is saying judgment is coming in this generation on Jerusalem, and it did.
Yeah, interesting. Well, thank you. I appreciate that explanation. That certainly, I think, gives me a little bit of gives me some understanding. I mean, that your answer didn't make sense about faith. I appreciate that.
Well, Nathan, I appreciate your call.
Thank you very much, Steve.
God bless you, man.
God bless you.
Bye now.
Bye.
All right, you're listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and if you'd like to give me a call, you can. We've got a line open for you at 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. If you'd like to be on the program, if you have a question about Christianity or about the Bible or about anything related to that, feel free to give me a call. Or if you disagree with the host and want to say why, you're always welcome to call and say so. Our next caller is Chris, calling from Portland, Oregon. Hi, Chris. Welcome to the Narrow Path. I'm trying to activate your line, Chris. Hang in there. It's not. There we go. I've got it.
Hi. It's actually Cliff.
Oh, Cliff. Sorry. My call screen, I think I heard you wrong.
Yeah, I have an additional comment about the fig tree, destruction of the fig tree. That I thought was really insightful. I liked all you said about the all the things about Jerusalem are very true. But there's something that may be good, applicable to our lives that I've heard that I would like to share with you and see what you think.
Sure.
Of it. That something about the fig tree, the way it grows, the figs come before the leaves each year. Maybe you've heard this, but I just wanted to. And that it's the fruit comes first, and then the leaves come afterwards. And so when Jesus finds a fig tree with all its leaves out, but no fruit, it's like, it's almost unnatural. And it's a parable for our lives where our fruit must come first before the trappings and the things that look good.
Yeah. Well, I've heard that. I don't know very much about horticulture at all. I know
yeah, yeah.
Nothing specifically about fig trees, but I've also heard what you just said, that when a fig tree has leaves, it usually also has fruit.
Yeah.
And even though, you know, when Jesus saw the tree, Mark tells us, in Mark's parallel, he says that it was not the time for figs, that it wasn't the season for figs. But some fig trees apparently got their figs and their leaves early, and this tree had leaves. So, if I'm not misinformed about this, about fig trees, that is, then by having leaves, the fig tree was advertising that it had fruit.
Yeah, that's another part of the point. I get it from Winky Pratney, who
I know him.
Has some chemistry and background and whatnot. He lived in too long.
Yeah, he was a chemist before he was a preacher. Yeah.
Yeah. So I just didn't. It's kind of a. It reminds me that my spiritual fruit really needs to be first, and not just and avoid looking.
Not just show. Not just the leaves of show. See, that's it. I think that if this is correct, it is applicable to us and to everybody. But it was also applicable to, say, the religious system in Jerusalem at the time, in that there was a lot of outward show of righteousness, but there was no real spiritual fruit under all those leaves.
Yeah, yeah. In that way, we understand why they were cursed, why there was specifically what it was that there was no fruit of. Anyway, it's kind of obvious to most readers of that passage. I mention it. It's good to hear from you again. I met you years and years ago at your Bible study that you held there in Salem 15 years ago when I lived in Salem.
Wow. You mean in the morning at the restaurant?
Yeah, at the restaurant.
Wow.
Over there off Market Street. So, yeah.
Yeah, well, that was a long time ago. Good to hear from you again.
Yeah. Bless you very much. Your show is always encouraging for me.
Great. I appreciate that encouragement.
Yeah.
God bless you.
Have a good day. Bye.
Okay, you too. Bye now. All right, we're going to talk next to Jonathan, who's calling from Albany, Oregon. And we have a line open for you. The number is 1-800-438-5090. We have a lot of time left if you want to get on. We've got about 20 minutes, actually. But you got to get in line and be glad to talk to you on today's program if you give me a call. 1-800-438-5090. Jonathan, welcome to the Narrow Path.
Hi, this is...
Hi.
How are you doing, Steve?
Fine. Did I get your name right?
Yes.
Good. Okay, never know for sure.
Yeah. My question was about entertainment. I mean, there's a lot of stuff coming out, and, you know, I guess my question is what guidelines should Christians have for what type of entertainment they view? Because, I mean, you have... Because, you know, there's some people who feel like it's okay to watch things like Harry Potter, and then there's other Christians who are like, oh no, that's totally wrong, or you know, some people, the different types of video games they play or whatever, you know, might have violence, and some things might use the Lord's name in vain, and some people are like, oh, well, I'm okay with that, and other people's aren't, and you see what I'm saying? So what do you think?
I do.
About?
Well, it's a nuanced question, you know, because Paul said, all things are lawful to me, but I will not be brought into bondage to any. And he said, all things are lawful to me, but he says, not all things are edifying. Not all are expedient for our spiritual well-being. Now, when Paul said all things are lawful to me, he was actually talking about food. And one might say he wasn't talking about things such as entertainment. And there is, of course, one difference between food and entertainment. Both are consumed by consumers, but food goes into the body and goes out again, where entertainment goes into the brain and usually sticks there. Images from it, messages from it, they can actually shape the character. You know, if you eat meat sacrificed to idols, it's not something that meat is not going to change your personality or change your morals necessarily. But if you consume, entertainment of the wrong sort, it can definitely corrupt your morals. Now, on the other hand, it is difficult. It is possible to apply those verses in this way, that there is no law in the Bible, that at least not in the New Testament, that says we have to withdraw completely from seeing and hearing all things evil. Obviously, David said in Psalm 101, David said, "I will not bring any abominable thing into my house. I won't let any abominable thing be before my eyes," and so forth, which is a pretty good resolve to have. And so many Christians feel that, you know, they need to basically not have anything in their range of vision or in their hearing that is unedifying, because it's an abominable thing. Now, on the other hand, the New Covenant has one significant difference from the Old Covenant. David lived under the Old, and in the Old Covenant, people were required to be holy, but they were not given the inner resources to overcome temptation in their environment. And that's why God, when he had Israel go into Canaan, he had them exterminate all the Canaanites, because he's quite sure that if the Canaanites remained there, they would corrupt Israel. Israel had the law, but they didn't have the inward righteousness and the inward love for God and so forth that would make it easy for them to keep the law in the presence of challenges and temptations from other cultures around them. On the other hand, Jesus comes and he brings a new life. He brings the Holy Spirit, and he, unlike, say, the holy men of times previous to his time, he actually goes and has contact with people and things that under the Old Covenant would make a person unclean. Touching a leper would make a man unclean in the Old Testament. Touching a woman who had an issue of blood would make a man unclean in the Old Testament. But in the New Testament, Jesus touches a leper, and Jesus doesn't become unclean. The leper becomes clean. And likewise, the woman with the issue of blood touches him, and he doesn't become unclean. She becomes healed. And this is because of the dynamic of the Holy Spirit in the New Covenant life of Christ, which now we have. And I think that is the difference between the Old Testament believer and the New Testament believer, that the Old Testament believer had obligation to stay holy, but had no inner resource to do it. So they had to be protected from every wicked influence because they had no strength to resist. But a true Christian, a true born-again Christian, has God's nature living inside them and can live in a corrupt world, can see and hear things that are corrupt and not necessarily be corrupted by them. Now, we can be corrupted too. Obviously, if we walk in the Spirit, we will not fulfill the lust of the flesh, and we can then, like Jesus, we can touch an unclean person and they'll be made clean, not us be unclean, so to speak. But how does that affect your question? Well, we can live in a world where we hear profanity without it making us profane. We can live in a world where we see immodesty without it making us immodest. That doesn't mean we want to see and hear those things. It doesn't mean we find those things entertaining. It just means that it's not always the case that to see and hear evil things must necessarily make the Christian evil or corrupt him. It depends on whether that person is in the Spirit or not. Now, that would depend on, or that would be dictated by, what your motives are for being exposed to it. For example, if you feel that you want to reach a certain group of bikers skinheads or people at some bar, and you know you're going to be exposed to their music, you're going to be exposed to their bad language, you're going to be exposed to their, blasphemous tattoos or whatever, but you don't have to be afraid of that. If God is sending you into their midst for any reason, then you can actually reach out to them and have an impact on them, like David Wilkerson did with the gangs in New York. and not necessarily be corrupted, because God is leading you there. See, if you're going there for good motives, if you're being led by the Spirit, then the Spirit of God is a life dynamic that overcomes the power of the corruption, at least in terms of your own sanctity. But if you're going there because you want to simply enjoy the music or enjoy the sights, I mean, in other words, if you take some delight in the profanity and the immodesty and the immorality, then you're not walking in the Spirit. I mean, you're in the flesh. Now, how does that impact the question of watching a movie, let us say, that has profanity in it, or a movie that has some nudity in it, or something like that? Well, I mean, for many people, it's just a given. If it's got profanity, it can't be a godly thing for you to watch it. Well, that's like saying it's not a godly thing for you to hear profanity because you go someplace where people are speaking that way to reach them. I would say, although nobody goes to the movies probably to reach people for Christ, there may be innocent reasons or even edifying reasons for going to a movie. I have seen some movies that were very edifying, Christian movies. I think of the movie The Mission, for example. Now, The Mission was, in almost all respects, a very edifying movie. Now, it had a lot of nudity because it was set in a jungle where a lot of native women were bare-breasted. And there was even a part of the movie where it showed a man lying in bed with a lady who wasn't his wife. And it showed a sword fight where one brother killed another brother in a duel. Now, all those things are really unchristian things. Those things in themselves are very unedifying things, and generally speaking, I wouldn't care to watch those things for entertainment. On the other hand, the overall impact of the movie was very edifying. It was very glorifying to God, I thought, and it inspired me to be, a better Christian. So, you know, there were things in the movie which, taken by themselves, would not be attraction to me. I'd prefer the movie not to have those things in it. On the other hand, there may be overriding virtues in the movie, or reasons to see it that are truly spiritual reasons, and where a Christian can, or feels they can, expose themselves to sometimes bad language, sometimes immodest things, and the Christian knows that this is not corrupting me, and this movie or this thing is actually edifying. Let me give you another example. And that is secular music. Now, my ex-wife could not listen to secular music, and I don't care to listen to it very much. I'm not much of a music listener. Actually, when I'm driving or something, I'd rather have talk radio or a CD of someone teaching or something than to listen to music most of the time, Christian or otherwise. I'm not a big listener to music. But I don't have any problem listening to secular music. It's just a lot of it I wouldn't have any interest in hearing. But the interesting thing is my wife and I could listen to the same song and have exactly different experiences. Because when she had been young, and if she was hearing music from, say, the late 60s or the early 70s, a period of time where she was not a Christian, those songs, when she heard them, brought back to her mind very unedifying behaviors, things she was doing at the time before she was a Christian, and so forth. And, you know, to hear a song from the early 70s simply brought back to her bad feelings, bad memories, very unedifying things, images, and so forth. Now, on the other hand, in the early 70s, I was in a revival. I was playing in a Christian band. I was preaching the gospel. I was rejoicing in God. And our band, this was back before they had even cassette tapes, you know, they had 8-track tapes. But as we were driving to a place to preach the gospel, we'd be listening either to the radio or we'd be listening to maybe an 8-track tape of something like, you know, Abbey Road or something of that period of time. And, you know, those were secular things. But our minds were in an entirely different state. Almost every time I heard a secular song in those days, I was trying to interpret it. Somehow about Jesus, because everything I was looking at was about him. And when I hear those songs today, it brings back those positive spiritual feelings and spiritual memories of that revival time that I heard them in. So So could everybody listen to, you know, the Beatles? Could everyone listen to music from the 70s and be edified? Apparently not. I know some who cannot. I can, and maybe there's others who can too. I'm not sure. So it's very difficult. It's actually quite inappropriate for one Christian to say that another Christian cannot be properly entertained or edified through a certain medium, a certain music or movie or something like that.
So
no doubt there are some movies that have nothing redeeming about them. In fact, probably most of them have nothing redeeming about them. But there are some movies that are actually quite worthwhile in various ways, which a person might go to for very good motives, and yet when they go there, they find that there's a few words they don't like, there's a few images they don't like, there's a few philosophies expressed by people they don't like, and yet the overall benefit is worth the exposure.
So would you say then that a good standard for a Christian to have is if it edifies you in the Lord and in your walk, then it's okay?
I think so. I think everything we do should be with that in mind, that when I come out of this experience, whether it's a conversation with a friend, whether it's going to church, whether it's going to a concert, whether it's going to a movie, no matter what I'm doing, whether I'm going to the beach, when I'm done with this, when I'm done with this activity, will I be as close or closer to God than I was before I did it? Because that's really what we want. We want to be closer to God. And if we want to be close to God, it may be that seeing certain movies and hearing certain songs have a counterproductive influence on that goal. And even though no one can say, well, the Bible says you can't see that movie, well, it doesn't. But while it may be lawful, it may not be edifying. And that's what we need to make our decisions on.
Well, so what about, like, you know, riding your bike then? I mean, that's not necessarily edifying in the Lord, per se, or like playing sports. What if you want to do something just to entertain yourself and it's not necessarily going to edify your spirit?
Well, I don't believe that there's... Okay, edify your spirit. I need to clarify this. Okay. I think any time we do what we think God wants us to do, it is potentially edifying, just knowing that we're doing this and that it pleases God. Now, is God pleased for people to play sports? Perhaps he is sometimes. Is he pleased for someone to ride a bicycle? That could well be at times. I mean... if a person is riding a bicycle or playing sports because they, you know, they get totally stressed out in their work and they need to unwind, or because they're trying to, you know, do something for the environment, so they ride their bike instead of driving a car. I mean, they can do those kinds of things to the glory of God. Recreation, God made people for recreation. I mean, if you go out for a hike in the woods or in the mountains, and you're rejoicing in the beauty of God's creation, that can be edifying, but it's only recreational. Playing sports can be recreational. You can play to the glory of God. I mean, think of Eric Little, you know. Did you see the movie Chariots of Fire? I mean, there's two runners there, one a Jew and one a Christian, and the Jew was doing it for his own self-aggrandizement, and the Christian just wanted to glorify God, and they were both runners. Sports can be done to the glory of God. Almost anything can be if it's not a sinful thing.
So could somebody watch Family Guy and do it for the glory of God? Because I know Christians who watch Family Guy, and that just bothers me to no end because it makes fun of our Lord so much.
I know. I have to admit I've seen Family Guy, and I have to admit I found some of it funny, but when it had God or Jesus on there, I had to turn it off. It's too profane. And I don't watch TV regularly. In fact, I don't even have a TV. The only time I've seen Family Guy is when someone else was watching it. But I can't watch some of that stuff without, you know. I don't know why people aren't sensitive to that more. But I think it's because we've been anesthetized to it. Our entertainment has gotten more and more profane, more and more irreverent, and I think that people have just gotten numb to it, like the frog in the kettle. And I think that. Again, I don't feel I can judge somebody else for what they're watching or listening to, but I think everyone needs to judge themselves.
Okay.
And because, I mean, when you stand before God, you're going to want to be able to justify the things you spent your time doing, and you're going to want to do things now that won't make you regret that you did them when you stand before God, or even an hour later after you've done them. You know, still, I don't know, there are Christian movie reviewers who go to movies that I would not wish to see, and they review them for Christians. Now, I might say, well, I don't know if a Christian should go to that movie, but that's between them and God. If they feel like that's part of their ministry, I can't really say what they should or shouldn't do about that. I know this, that I like to, if I listen to secular music, I usually like to listen to recorded music that I can choose rather than on the radio or something. And I used to have several albums, I probably still do somewhere, by Jackson Browne. Now, Jackson Browne was no Christian by any stretch of the imagination. And, he sang about things like cocaine and stuff like that that I've never used. I've never used cocaine. But when I listen to his music, people might say they may doubt me, but I before God, when I listened to his music, it edified me because it put me in touch with the world outside that I've never been a part of and made me see how empty it is and made me appreciate my salvation so much more because, Jackson Browne, almost all his songs, one of the most common words in any of his songs is the word emptiness, describing his own life, at least in his older stuff, which is all I ever listened to. But, I've never had an empty life. My life has always been full. I've always been satisfied in Jesus. And when I hear a person, a famous person, who's got money and fame, and he's talking about how empty his life is, I find that, frankly, very edifying. It makes me so appreciative of the fact that I'm not him and that I don't live in the world he's living in. But it also wakes me up to the fact that all these people around me in this world, they are living in that world, and I would never know how empty they were, because I'm not. I would never know how empty they were if I didn't hear stuff like that. And so it really kind of puts me in touch with my fellow man a little more, although I don't like to listen to music very often. I'm just saying that if I was listening to Jackson Browne sing a song about cocaine, it doesn't in any way attract. I've never been attracted to use drugs in my life, but it actually speaks to me about the things that people who don't know Jesus are trapped in and what they're...
What do you think, really quick, this is the last thing and I'm done, what do you think of the whole, like, fantasy genre, like Harry Potter, Lord of the Rings type thing that's getting all real famous and stuff and the television and all that?
I don't participate in it, so I don't know much about it. I wasn't even interested in seeing the Harry Potter movies for a long time, and then some friends of mine had them, and I watched one or two of them with them, and I thought, but when I heard about Harry Potter but hadn't seen it, I thought it was going to be really super, like an evangelism piece for witchcraft. But when I saw it, it didn't really strike me as being any more serious than the old TV show Bewitched. I mean, it's not real witchcraft. It's riding on a broom and it's doing things that, witches really don't do. If it had been as I thought it was going to be, if it had been really just a depiction of the more glamorous side of real witchcraft, so that people watching might say, hey, I'd like to be a witch so I could, be involved in that, then I would say it's extremely dangerous. And maybe it is dangerous. I don't know as it is, but it seems to me that no one would take witchcraft seriously watching it. Now, I could be wrong. Maybe a lot of people do. But, some Christians like it. I don't. I didn't enjoy Harry Potter. But I wasn't shocked by it. I expected it to be a lot more appealing. I expected it to actually be the kind of thing that would draw more people into witchcraft. Now, maybe it has. But when I saw it, I couldn't figure out why it would. It looked like just fantasy stuff, just like Mickey Mouse and, the magician's nephew or whatever, Anyway, I'm afraid I'm out of time here. I hear music playing. And,
well, thank you.
I have to go. But I appreciate your call, Jonathan.
Bye.
Bye now. You've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg. This is a daily program, Monday through Friday at this same time. We are a listener-supported ministry. We pay for the radio time that we use, and it's very expensive, but we don't have any sponsors. We just depend on listener support. And if you'd like to help us stay on the air in your area, you can write to us at The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 3633, Santa Cruz, California, 95063. That's The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 3633, Santa Cruz, California, 1-800-250-9563. Our website is www.thenarrowpath.com. Lots of free resources there, thenarrowpath.com. My name is Steve Gregg. Thanks for joining us. Tune in again tomorrow, and we'll continue this discussion.